A judge puts a hold on all federal funding for embryonic stem cell research.
So what does that mean for the research going forward?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bob Moon, in for Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, August 24th. It's the proverbial wrench that's been thrown into scientific and medical research. That's coming up.
South Africa's Mr. Zuma goes to China. People are going nowhere on a freeway outside of Beijing. And will New York City go along with a plan to build a skyscraping equal? All that ahead. Right now, we're going to ask the big question. It has to do with funding for scientific and medical stem cell research involving human embryos. A U.S. district judge has put a hold on all federal funding for such research, and that decision could cripple medical labs across the country that rely on the hundreds of millions of federal research dollars. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ruled that guidelines set by the Obama administration don't comply with a 1996 law. It banned federal funding for research that destroys human embryos. When President Obama took office, he changed the rules so that research using embryos that had already been destroyed could get federal dollars. Doug Melton directs the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. His group depends on millions of dollars in federal funding for stem cell research that holds promise for treating heart disease and diabetes. He says the ruling will slow down, but not stop, his institute's work.
This ruling will bring us back to a time when we have to be especially careful about how we appropriate funds from different sources and go through, frankly, a lot of red tape.
Melton says his group gets most of its funding from private philanthropies. Private funding is not affected by the ruling. It's not clear whether the Obama administration will challenge the court's decision. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Japanese yen just hit a 15-year high against the dollar. Let's explore why investors in Japan are so skittish. At the same time, the yen has hit that 15-year peak. Bill Stone joins us from PNC Wealth Management in Philadelphia. Good morning. So what's going on with the yen?
Good morning. You know what? It's really, truly a symptom of this global flight to safety. You know, it's helped some what I'll call safe havens like the Japanese yen and like U.S. treasuries, and certainly hurt others like global stocks in general and the Japanese stock market in particular.
And the broader economic implications of that might be?
You know, I think the broader implication, particularly for Japan, is just further headwinds for Japanese exports and certainly some more headwinds for their economy. Because even when you talk about the fact that the yen has gotten strong versus the dollar has actually been a relatively strong currency. So relative to almost all the other major currencies, the yen is even stronger than that, if that makes any sense.
Okay, back to those latest earnings numbers. Does this just pile the pressure on Wall Street?
You know, I think yes. You know, second quarter earnings so far on the whole have been very good. They're kind of a lot in Wall Street's rearview mirror. But the fact is the short-term economic data we've been getting has not been helpful. In fact, I'd call it pretty poor. So these certainly, the recent earnings disappointment certainly won't help us today.
Bill Stone at PNC Wealth Management, thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
If you happen to be stuck in traffic right now, be glad you're not in Beijing. A traffic jam there is in its 10th, yes, 10th day. Since August 14th, thousands of vehicles have stretched for more than 60 miles. It's taken some drivers 3 days to get through. The official explanation is road construction, but as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, it's actually about the number of cars on the road.
Back when this traffic jam started, Tiger Woods was married, Dr. Laura still had a job, and China was still behind Japan as the second largest economy in the world. Not that anyone sitting for days in their cars along China's National Expressway 110 noticed. They were too busy getting ripped off by a guerrilla economy that sprung up amidst the gridlock. According to state-run news reports, vendors are taking advantage of drivers' desperation by selling them instant noodles for four times the price. There's not much else to eat in the Beijing traffic that's backed up all the way to Inner Mongolia. Reports say the congestion could last more than a month. Shomik Mendorada is an urban transportation expert with the World Bank in Beijing. He says while this particular gridlock is impacting mostly freight trucks, the event is a symbol of how China's roads are inundated with traffic.
as the country gets richer and becomes more and more urban and more people start being able to buy and drive cars, more and more people do.
Last year, China had 72 million registered vehicles on its roads, not nearly as many as the quarter billion the U.S. has, but just this year, China surpassed the U.S. in car sales. The World Bank's Mendurada says China's cities should not prepare for this by building more highways. He says that would just cause more traffic and pollution. Instead, he says, they should invest in bringing back a hallmark of Chinese transportation that's on its way to being forgotten here, the bicycle. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
South Africa's president is in China today. Officials there in South Africa say the two countries are set to sign some key free trade deals. The visit is just South Africa's latest effort to reach out to several of the world's fastest growing economies. Reporter Gretchen Wilson is in Johannesburg. She's with us this morning to talk about it. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us more about this visit. What's at stake with this visit?
Well, South Africa is like many African economies. It grew steadily in recent years, but quickly had to downshift when the global economy slowed down. That's because overseas markets cut back spending on commodities, things like copper, platinum, and aluminum. President Jacob Zuma's message in China is that Africa's biggest economy is open for business. He's looking for new investment, and he wants to create jobs and infrastructure back home. He also wants to narrow the trade deficit with Beijing. He's hoping that China will buy more from South Africa than just raw materials. Zuma's really made it a priority in recent months to visit each of the so-called BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And this is his last stop on that tour. He really wants to nail down South Africa's place among emerging economies, and he wants those countries to see South Africa as a gateway into the rest of Africa.
Well, then, Gretchen, how's his visit being received back home?
Well, it might have been a huge deal originally, but his message was really hijacked when the main economic story in South Africa became the government worker strike that's going on now. More than a million teachers and nurses went on strike last week to demand wage increases, so state schools are empty, hospitals are actually operating on skeleton crews, and volunteers are keeping emergency rooms running.
And bottom line, what are they striking about?
Well, they want a greater stake in the country's growth on the international stage. So while Zuma's negotiating trade deals with China, government employees are saying they want a piece of that success. They want to hold out for a higher wage increase than the 7% that the state is offering.
Reporter Gretchen Wilson from Johannesburg, South Africa. Gretchen, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 24th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. 1 week from today, millions of BlackBerry phones in India could be crippled by the government if the smartphone maker does not agree to unlock some of the private data. But now the government faces new pressure to back down from those threats, getting pushback from business travelers and visitors. The latest from New Delhi and reporter Raymond Thibodeau.
Many in India say the government's ignoring how critical the BlackBerry is to business. Harjeev Singh is co-founder of the public relations firm Gutenberg Communications. He travels between New York and New Delhi.
I hope they come up with a solution pretty quickly because it's not just me. I have my entire team in India that uses BlackBerry.
BlackBerry maker Research in Motion has just one more week to comply with India's demand to let the government decrypt the phone's email system. Bharat Karnad is a security analyst for the Center for Policy Research.
It's obviously been determined by our intelligence agencies that media such as the BlackBerry is used by Islamic terrorists and other terrorist outfits.
It's not just business travelers who'd be angered by a shutdown. The country's hosting the Commonwealth Games Sporting Championships in less than 2 months' time. Many of the organizers use the device. Plus, India's been hoping to lure tourists in the afterglow of the movie Eat, Pray, Love. And to be fair, visitors coming for that purpose would have discovered that many of the country's ashrams and yoga centers already ban cell phones. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
A lot of bloggers in Philadelphia are up in arms over that city's latest proposal to bring in money. It would charge internet bloggers that sell advertising on their sites a privilege fee and business tax. A lot of cities and states are having a tough time balancing budgets, so they're going after any revenue they can get. Sri Srinivasan is professor of digital media at Columbia Journalism School. He's with us live from New York this morning. Hi, professor.
Hello.
Is there even a way to enforce this on bloggers?
It's going to be almost impossible to enforce this because trying to track these folks down and then getting them to pay for this is going to be hard. Let's keep in mind that I think somewhere between 95 and 99% of bloggers don't make money on what they do. So
they just do it to get their opinions out there, right?
That they do that. They love what they do. And some of them make some money, but this is just a sign of the times. Municipalities need money, and they're going to go where they can try to find some money.
Are we going to see any more of this, you think, Professor? I know we've been hearing about an internet tax for a few months now. Is this just a way to get revenue?
Well, we've been talking about internet taxes, I think, for years now, and I think that you will see versions of this coming out from all over the country if there is any sign that there is actually money to be got for these from these bloggers. If there isn't, if Philadelphia is not successful, I don't think it's going to happen elsewhere. But people are going to, the governments are going to try.
So it could be a barometer then what happens in Philly. What does this say, Professor, about the state of blogs and their legitimacy? We have about 20 seconds.
I think that it's nice in some ways to say that people are, governments are thinking that there are all these people making money on there. But blogs have been around for a long time, relatively speaking, and I think it's a sign that they think there are enough people making money. And there are some people making money, but not everybody.
Professor Sri Srinivasan at Columbia Journalism School in New York. Professor, thanks.
Thank you.
Are you a jailbreaker? For years, users of the Apple iPhone have been engaging in that practice. We're talking about hacking into your cell phone so you can use software that hasn't been sold and authorized by Apple. The government recently decided the practice is not illegal, but it also didn't stop phone makers from doing what they can to stop it. And now Apple is turning to the U.S. Patent Office, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Apple has applied for a patent that would allow it to identify unauthorized jailbreakers. It could take pictures of users, record their voices, even monitor their heartbeats. If unauthorized use is suspected, Apple could restrict access or even delete information from the phone. Tech analyst Charles Galvin with Forrester Research says it's probably not as devious as it sounds, that Apple simply wants more control over the user experience.
I think the idea that your iPhone would constantly be monitoring your heartbeat and acting in a very big brother-like way is pretty far from, I think, the Apple ideal of how customers experience their products. And I think it's unlikely that they would go to that extreme.
Apple is refusing to comment. Tech analyst Rob Enderle says the company may have another motive in mind, to compete with its more secure rivals in the market for business customers.
It really does look to be more along the lines of securing the phone and allowing the phone to better address the competitive threat represented by BlackBerry and, to a much lesser extent, Microsoft.
The Patent Office says it may take a year or more for any final word on Apple's patent application. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
How many times have you checked the box on this question? Have you ever been convicted of a felony? Many job applications ask, of course, but advocates for ex-cons say the question handcuffs those who want to stay on the straight and narrow through legitimate employment. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio says Detroit is the latest city to consider banning the box.
Inside a Detroit office building, half a dozen men sit in a narrow room listening to Derek Blackman give advice about finding a job. Blackman works for a program called Flip the Script with Goodwill Industries, and the guys he's counseling have all been recently released from prison.
What else is good or bad about the interview?
You can tell them that you're going to be on a good, hard worker. You're going to be on
hey,
work on
my
time.
Man, I work.
You're going to be at work on time.
The building. I was waiting.
Right.
You can sell yourself.
But many ex-offenders will never get to the interview. That's because checking the felony conviction box on the job application will often send their forms straight to the reject pile. So Detroit could soon remove the question from government job applications and make city contractors do the same. City Councilman Ken Cockrell is sponsoring the proposed ordinance. He says some people are worried the policy could be an affirmative action program for criminals. But Cockrell says applicants will still have to undergo background checks for some jobs.
And that's important because obviously you don't want somebody that's got multiple drunk driving convictions getting a job driving a DDOT bus. But if you're a person that's maybe just applying to cut grass on city-owned property, yeah, you shouldn't necessarily be penalized or asked whether or not you did something 20 years ago.
It's estimated that about 27,000 people in Detroit are on probation or parole. And advocates for ex-cons say shutting them out of the workforce is bad for the city in the long run. Keith Bennett runs the Flip the Script program.
You get in where you fit in. And if these people can't fit back into society, they'll get back into life of crime. And we're going to pay for that.
Detroit is not the first city to consider the change. Boston and Chicago have already dropped the question from job applications. But officials in those cities say it's difficult to tell whether more ex-cons are finding gainful employment. That's because the poor economy means there's not much hiring going on. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
And finally, the owners of the Empire State Building stopped just short yesterday of labeling a would-be rival the monster that ate Midtown Manhattan. They say a new tower planned just a couple of avenues to the west would be an assault on the city's familiar skyline and a monstrosity that would diminish the iconic status of their 79-year-old skyscraper.
The new building would top out just 34 feet shy of the Empire State Building's 1,250 feet. Mm. It could go up near Penn Station if the city council votes tomorrow to clear the final regulatory hurdle.
Now, developers say the project will bring thousands of jobs and help the city grow and prosper.
Or will the existing landmark be allowed to stand alone, something more like the entire state building? In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.